Barbara Honecker. And we're going to talk about some amazing things tonight. Let me give you an introduction of Barbara's background. She served in high-level positions in the U.S. government, including White House policy analyst, special assistant to the president, and director of the Attorney General's Gender Discrimination Law Review at the Department of Justice, where she was the highest-ranking official for women's rights in the federal government. From 1995 to 2011, Ms. Honecker served as senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School, the premier science, technology, and national security affairs graduate research university of the U.S. Department of Defense.
But of course, what's amazing is that everybody, I've been a speaker at JFK conferences on the parallels, usually between 9/11 and the JFK assassination, on the cover-ups especially, for years. And what's amazed me is that no one in these kind of mainstream JFK truth community conferences, they won't have anything to do with James Files. They assume he's lying. But James Files is telling the truth, and now we know for sure. Because all of these years, since 1996, with his first interview in prison, or so, 1996 or so, James Files has revealed the fact that he used a single mercury-filled bullet in his long-barreled gun. It wasn't a rifle. It was a long-barreled handgun. And he was such a sharp shooter, such a good shot, that he only needed one bullet. And he had it specially filled with mercury. In fact, it was one of five or six or so mercury-filled bullets that he had had his specialist do for him, his mafia bullet maker specialist in the Chicago area. Do for him that he says that he had used before. He had used some of those bullets to kill other people, presumably from the CIA beforehand.
Barbara, can I please just interrupt?
Yes, absolutely.
We had James Files on the show a year ago because I really have been trying to back him every single step I've been able to for many, many years. So yeah. I'm very happy that you bring him up also.
Yes, it's very, very important. And so I'm going to give you a few more data points if you have any question whatsoever. So we have the data point of, I mean, it's an extremely unusual thing to have a mercury-filled bullet, number one. James Files has been telling the truth about his mercury-filled bullet shot from behind the grassy knoll fence for years. Okay. But now we have David Mantic finding the proof of that very bullet's trajectory inside JFK's brain. And that's extremely important. And then there's another data point that's very important. And that is a book, another book. And I'm now going to hold that up. It's called The Inheritance. Can you see this? Okay, it's by Christopher Fulton. And Christopher Fulton's a very important author. Christopher Fulton, I have reason to believe, I'm not going to go into the details here, but the source was Christopher Fulton himself, who spoke to him on the phone. It appears that Christopher Fulton is not his real name, is that he is actually an illegitimate son of Robert Kennedy. And so for years after I read the book, The Inheritance, which is about the watch, the Cartier watch that Jackie Kennedy had given to JFK for one of their anniversaries, that JFK was wearing on his left wrist in the limousine. So when the mercury-filled bullet shot him in the head, a cloud of mercury went up. And amongst other things, not only on the clothes, on the seat of the limousine, everywhere, you can actually see that cloud. But it also, of course, got on the watch. And this mercury is, if you don't know it's there, you don't know what to look for. It's kind of invisible. But you can do a chemical analysis and find it. Well, making a long story short, in the book of The Inheritance, I couldn't figure out why the book was called The Inheritance all these years until I learned that he is almost certainly an illegitimate son of Robert Kennedy. JFK's brother, of course, and then Attorney General. Well, Robert Kennedy inherited all of this, all of these, like the watch and a lot of other things that were JFK's personal possessions. And then for whatever reason, and you learn about this in the book, The Inheritance, that property that was JFK's, including the Cartier watch, was then willed to JFK's famous secretary. And then when she died, her husband took over them, and they were all put together in the basement of his house in Washington, in the Washington D.C. area, where the author Christopher Fulton was contacted, and he was given or bought I can't remember exactly, but he became the owner of the watch. And when the United States government, the Department of Justice, learned that the watch was no longer, was now in the possession of Christopher Fulton and his wife, they made this man's life literal hell. They staged an alleged murder that he allegedly did. He had to flee to Canada. Then he was extradited. He was put in solitary confinement for this alleged crime. But the only real crime was that he wouldn't give up the watch. And so finally, the watch went to, this is in the book, The Inheritance. And now what's important about the watch is that it still had the traces of mercury on it. That's what matters. And you learn this in the book. But the watch finally, Christopher Fulton needed money and he wanted to sell the watch. So it went to auction. And the reserve of the preview of the auction was held in none other than Trump Tower. And you can be certain Donald Trump was there. So Donald Trump knew about this watch. It's very important to him, apparently. Donald Trump knows the truth about the Kennedy assassination. He's known about it for years. When the watch got up on the stand and the auctioneer had a earbud in his ear, suddenly he stopped the auction. And almost everybody was there for the watch. There were other items being of JFK's being auctioned. But almost everybody was there for the watch because it had been, forgive the pun, trumped up during the preview in Trump Tower. Okay, in all the newspapers in New York City and around the world. Okay, so the moment it came up on the roundy round, the auctioneer heard something in his ear and he apologized. He said, I'm having to withdraw the watch from the auction. Well, that, of course, upset Christopher Fulton and his watch, who were in the front row. And afterwards, they went back to the green room and they went up to the auctioneer and said, what the hell is going on? And he said, well, I got word in my ear that the Crown of Britain ordered that the auction be stopped because they are willing to pay any price. Money is not an object for the watch. Well, now Christopher Fulton was told the truth, okay? And it wasn't long after that that, of course, the government went after him and set him up for a murder and made his life hell, put him in prison, solitary confinement, etc. So he finally gets out. It's an amazing story, and you have to know it. But the important thing here is the connection between the JFK assassination and the British Crown. I think that's really important for people to know. So now I'm going to get into something else very important about the JFK assassination, because it's very important for people to understand. I have given a speech, a presentation about this at the JFK one of the JFK conferences in Dallas, actually twice, and it caused just a consternation in the audience. But I had a special luncheon with Fletcher Prouty, who is of course the author of The Secret Team. By Fletcher Prouty, and he is also the person that Mr. X of the JFK movie by Oliver Stone is based after. And he's a very important person because Fletcher Prouty, amongst many other things he did in his life, but Fletcher Prouty at the time of the lead up to the October Missile Crisis, the Bay of Pigs, and the Kennedy, the JFK assassination, Fletcher Prouty was the military's, he was an Air Force officer, he was the military's liaison to the CIA for all military personnel, equipment, ships, planes, drones, whatever, that the CIA would require for its paramilitary operations. And that included, of course, the Bay of Pigs, that included his involvement in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, as many people know, he was sent to Antarctica, of all places, before about 10 days before the JFK assassination. And right afterwards, he was in Australia or New Zealand, where he saw the headlines. And so everybody's supposed to believe that he was one of the good guys. Well, relatively speaking, he was. But I'm now going to tell you who he really was. Because one, after I was completed my 76-page timeline for my book, October Surprise, on the truth behind the Iran side of the Iran-Contra scandal and the theft of the 1980 election from President Carter by Ronald Reagan and his then vice presidential running mate, George Bush Sr. That's my book, October Surprise. When I had done the 76-page chronology for my book, and I had sent it to my friend and political godmother, Sarah McClendon, who was the senior White House correspondent. She had been White House correspondent in the White House press room for 8 or 9 straight presidencies, more even than Helen Thomas. And I was so close to her that when I visited, whenever I was in Washington, she would have me stay at her house and sleep in her bed if she was working into the wee hours of the morning. So she was literally like a mother to me. So I sent it to Sarah McClendon because I wanted to know what she thought, because I was working on my book, October Surprise, which I hadn't published, of course, yet. And so I sent her my detailed reference timeline, 76 pages. And in a couple of weeks, I get this frantic call from Sarah. And she said, "Barbara, you have to come to Washington, D.C., and you have to come to Washington, D.C. immediately." And I said, "Well, what's going on, Sarah? What's happened?" And she said, "Well, there's someone who says he must meet you, and he must meet you here. He can't come to California." And I said, "Well, who's that?" She said, "Well, I can't tell you. He won't let me tell you." And anyway, to make a longer story shorter, this person ended up being Fletcher Prouty. And I ended up pulling together the money. Sarah didn't have it either. But I got some money from family members and friends, and I was working at the time also. But it was an expensive ticket, and it was at the last minute, so it's always more expensive. I ended up, Sarah met me. She still drove then. She met me at the airport, what's now Reagan Airport, then National Airport, I guess. And she drove me to her house, and I said, "Sarah, okay, now you can tell me who this is." She said, "No, I can't. He won't let me let you know until he introduces himself at lunch tomorrow at the National Press Club." Okay. So the next day, I'm frustrated, but, you know, we talk about other things. So the next day, Sarah drives me to the National Press Club, where she is so famous that there is now the Sarah McClendon dining room, and there was even then, off of the main lobby. And so we get there, and I'm assuming that she's going to go in with this mystery man with me. And she said, no. He says he has to meet with you alone. And so she stayed in the lobby, of all things, the senior White House correspondent. And she told me how to walk down the, you know, around the corner and down the long aisle, and that he would be in a table for two at the end on the left. And so I did that. And at the end, about 20 feet from me, maybe, in a table for two was a man in dress white Air Force uniform with all of his medals. I think they call them ribbons. His hat was on the table, and he had a black leather briefcase. And he stood up regally in military attention as I walked forward. And when I got close, he said, "Are you Barbara?" And I said, "Yes." And then, very much an officer and a gentleman, he helped me with my chair, and he got right down to business. He opened his briefcase, and he took out a manila envelope, a little more than 8.5 by 11. And out of the manila envelope, he took what turned out to be my 76-page October Surprise t- timeline that Sarah had either given to him or given probably a copy, a Xerox copy. And it was face down, and he pushed it across this very small square table to me, and he said, please turn it over. Now, we hadn't had a conversation yet. This was like some kind of an interrogation. It was very strange. And so I turned it over and I said, oh, it's my timeline. It's the timeline for the book I'm doing. And then it turned into an actual interrogation. And he looked straight in my eyes. And I knew I was supposed to look at him. I had nothing to hide, of course, so I did. And he said, did you write this? And I said, yes. And he said, did you research this? And I said, yes. He said, did you research and write every word of this? And I said, yes. He said, so no one else helped you? I said, no. And then he just looked at me. We just looked at each other. We locked eyes. It seemed like a long time. But then, whatever it took, I'm sure he was a very highly trained interrogator. He was satisfied, whatever it took to satisfy him. And he said, very good. May I have it back? And I said, yes. And he put it back in the envelope, put it back in his briefcase, snapped the briefcase closed, put it down by him, and then put his hands on the table like this in front of me. And they almost, could have touched my plate on my side of the table. Because it was a very small table. And he leaned towards me and he said, very good. You did a very good job. And then he said, the people, this is an actual exact quote. He said, the people who run the world go to Haileybury Academy. And if you'd ever like to join us, just let me know. Well, I had no idea what Haileybury was. I do now. And I was kind of stunned. And I didn't really understand. But I wanted to know who I was having lunch with. And then he clapped his hands or did whatever he did. And there was some kind of cue he had already given to the waiter. It was a man who then came and took our lunch. And then we had a pleasant, it was almost as if none of that had happened. And then we had a pleasant lunch talking about how we both know Sarah and how amazing she is. And I knew his name was Fletcher Prouty. I didn't know who Fletcher Prouty was. I had no idea. I just knew that he was in either Navy or Air Force dress once. That's what I knew. My father was in the Navy. Okay. So, we have a pleasant lunch and then we walk out. And Sarah's still waiting for us, and there are pleasantries, and then Fletcher Prouty leaves. And then I sit there with Sarah McClendon in the couches there in the lobby of the National Press Club. And what was amazing is Sarah didn't ask me a single question about this. It was almost like after a UFO experience. It's very strange. But anyway, then we went back to Sarah's, and she had her lunch at home, and we had a pleasant time. And a day or two later, after doing things together, I went back to California. And because I'm a quintessential outsider, I'm not an insider. I want to know the truth from the outside of people of power. I don't want to be part of the power structure. I want to understand it and expose it. And so it didn't occur to me to even look up what Haileybury might be. Until 2015. Now, that's a long time. Because we're talking about, that would have been, this would have been before my book was published. It would have been in late 1986, probably, when Sarah called me to Washington to meet with Fletcher Prouty. So between 1986, approximately, sometime in 86, or early 87 at the very, very latest, and 2015, that's a long time. So at Thanksgiving dinner, this is all going to link back to the British Crown and the JFK assassination, by the way, from my personal experience with Fletcher Prouty. So In 2015, on Thanksgiving, my mother had unfortunately just passed away, and I had inherited, along with my brother, 50-50, her beautiful home in Carmel, California. And it was the last Thanksgiving I would ever have in our family home because we had to sell it. And so my brother and I had to sell it. So I had my best friends there. And it was the only time it wasn't a blood family Thanksgiving. It was a chosen family Thanksgiving. It was a wonderful Thanksgiving. And after we had a wonderful Thanksgiving meal and we were having our after dinner coffee or aperitifs or whatever, port, Dr. Peter Reynolds, who is an anthropologist and an archaeologist, he's a longtime friend of mine from Stanford University, where I got my degrees, my graduate degrees, undergraduate and graduate degrees. Dr. Reynolds, we after a nice meal on Thanksgiving, you talk about your life. And, it somehow came up, what are some amazing experiences in each of our lives? And it came to my mind to tell him about my lunch with Fletcher Prouty and what he said to me about Haley Berry. And Dr. Peter Reynolds, Professor Peter Reynolds, said, would you repeat that, please? And I said, repeat what? He said, what you just said, what he said, the people who run the world, where they are trained. And I said, well, he said something like Haley Berry Academy. And he said, don't you know what that is? And then he said something like, you accept it, of course. And I said, of course I didn't. And he said, well, get your laptop and Google it. And I did Google it. And the bottom line is, what is now Haley Berry, and it has different spellings, but it's still called Haley Berry. It is the current incarnation, if you will, of the East India Company, which was the main means by which the British Empire was created, its colonies, especially India. And so I was reading Wikipedia about Haley Berry. And today, and then, back in, 1986 or so, when I had my lunch with Fletcher Prouty, Haley Berry was already called Haley Berry. But even then, as of today, if you look up Haley Berry Academy, it's just I'm not sure what you call it, a grammar school academy for elite, the elite of Britain and the Commonwealth. And basically they train them to run their colonies. Okay. And so as I was reading what Haley Berry was and its ancestry in the East India Company, I realized, oh my God, I was being recruited for the British Empire. And what I inferred, now this is in an inference, but what I inferred from that was that from the British Crown's point of view, and this is the same British Crown that stopped the auction to get JFK's Cartier watch with the mercury from James Files' mercury-filled bullet on it, that what I inferred was that I was being recruited by the British Crown through Fletcher Prouty, who was an agent of the British Crown even then, in 1996 or so, and I inferred that the British Crown considers the United States still one of its colonies. And I think that's very important. And so from there, I'm going to go to the other most important book that everyone must get. It's called Regicide. Now, Regicide is by Gregory Douglass. Now, the only Regicide edition that matters is the first one, 2002, because what I'm going to tell you is in the back of this book. I think it's an appendix, but it's called Operation Zipper. It's about 25 of the most important pages of a document called Operation Zipper, which was leaked by a top CIA officer whose name was Crowley. And what this document is, the Zipper document, is how the CIA orchestrated the planning, execution, and cover-up of the JFK assassination. And what you learn is that the entire federal government, we're not talking about a deep state, we're just talking about the state, the United States government. The top officials of the entire United States CIA, intelligence community, Pentagon, and especially Alan Dulles and James Jesus Angleton, that they basically held a star chamber court-martial, effective court-martial, of the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, for what they considered to be high treason, and decided that he must be executed, that that was the sentence. And this is what's amazing, that he had to be executed publicly. Now, one of the big mysteries of the JFK assassination to me that I've never seen even addressed at a JFK conference, and I've been to, you know, a dozen of them in Dallas, including four or five at least that I've spoken at, invited presentation. No one has ever addressed why, if they just wanted all these people who met at the victory party at Clint Murchison's house the night before, if they just wanted to get rid of him, if they just wanted to kill him, there were a lot of easier ways to do it than blow his brains out in public with millions of people watching. And no one has ever addressed this, but you learn about it in the Zipper document. So once the author, Gregory Douglas, received the Zipper document, he decided that it had to be made public, and he published it as in the back of the first edition only of the book Regicide, R-E-G-I-C-I-D-E, published in 2002. So if you, they're hard to get, but you can. I have two copies. I got them both on Amazon, but be sure to get the first edition only. And you might be able to get them at rare booksellers online like abe.com, abe.com. But it's incredibly important because these people who decided in this Star Chamber court-martial to execute JFK publicly, they also let all of the people who are running our allies, UK, you know, NATO allies, let them all know that it was going to happen. And there's no question in my mind at all that Fletcher Prouty knew it was going to happen. Now, I think Fletcher Prouty was one of the good ones, but he misled the public into thinking that he was kept in the dark about what was going to happen. I don't think that's possible in any way. But I don't know for certain. I don't know for certain. So the JFK assassination, all right, it's very important for people to understand what really happened, and that James Files was recruited by the CIA through the head of the Chicago Mafia. And there were two top sharpshooters who were selected, and those were James Files, who shot from the grassy knoll, and Johnny Roselli, who was in the Daltex building next door to the school book depository on the other side of Dealey Plaza. Okay, now there were other shooters, but those were the ones that mattered. And the one that really mattered was James Files. Okay, now there is a connection directly between the JFK assassination and the Ronald Reagan assassination and the Trump assassination attempt, alleged assassination attempt of Trump. It was a real assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan. And Ollie is right. I was there that day. I was not at the hotel where he was shot going out the back door. But I was in the White House that day. And I was there throughout that entire experience, including that night and the night after. And I know some very important things that I've gone public about that I won't take the time to go into here, but we could do another show about it. But I know from personal experience that Ed Meese And Michael Deaver and Nancy Reagan personally decided that George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., who was then vice president, and under the 25th Amendment, if there ever was a time with Reagan having been shot and being effectively induced coma in the hospital, they weren't sure if he was going to survive. They knew he'd physically survive, but they weren't sure he was going to mentally be capable of taking over the office. If there ever was a time that the 25th Amendment should have been triggered and George Bush Sr. made acting president, that was it. But Nancy Reagan, Michael Deaver, and Ed Meese, three of the troika, the other third of the troika being James Baker, who represented George Bush Sr., vice president. But the other three, they personally decided, and I know this personally, I was there at the meeting where it was decided. They personally decided that they would not trigger the 25th Amendment because they didn't want George H.W. Bush to become vice president no matter what. And there's a good reason for that, because he was behind, the people behind him, in particular his favorite sharpshooter, who's Felix Rodriguez. Felix Rodriguez was the actual person who shot Ronald Reagan. It was not John Hinckley.